Welcome to The Divorce Social with me, Samantha Baines, changing the conversation around divorce. This show is sponsored by Penguin in the Room. Penguin in the Room is an award-winning arts marketing and social media management company. If you want to jazz up your socials and have someone Instagram and tweet for you, then here's your answer. Go to www.penguinintheroom.com. As always, hit subscribe to make sure you're updated about new episodes. And we love to hear from you on social media at DivorcePod and at Samantha Baines. You can also email us. All the info's on our website, thedivorcesocial.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I am joined by Kelly McMasters in this episode, all the way from the US. She's a writer. She has a new book coming out, The Leaving Season, a memoir in essays. We talk about her divorce, the pain of it, grief, but also celebration. So enjoy this one. I am joined by Kelly McMasters, essayist, professor, and former bookshop owner. Welcome to The Divorce Social.
Thanks so much, Samantha. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, we should say, because I can hear it in the background a little bit, your neighbors are having some leaf blowing done. It's not you with a vibrator on or something.
Not at the moment, no.
Leaf blowing does sound like a euphemism, though, doesn't it? I feel like.
Yes, yes. On Saturday, I'll be blowing my leaves. Yes.
I blow my leaves daily. It's good for you. So how do you feel about me welcoming you to The Divorce Social?
I'm so excited because I love putting those two words together. I think so much of divorce is about isolation, in my experience. And now post-divorce, happily divorced, I am really amazed at how much strength I get from other divorced folks. And I wish I could have tapped into that earlier. So I'm so excited that you're doing this.
Well, that's the whole point of setting up the podcast, really, was I felt isolated and I was like, people talk to me who've been divorced. And a podcast is a great excuse.
It is. It is. I wish I thought of it.
Well, there's still time.
Yeah.
So you're happily divorced. Does that feel nice?
Yes, it feels amazing. I think divorce is awful. Going through a divorce is terrible, but being divorced is amazing. And for me, the divorce itself was not happy. I wish I could say that, but it's not. However, I am very happy. So I'll take it.
I like that. When do you think you got happy? Was there a tipping over point?
I think there is a connection between happiness and hope for me. And I think so much of leaving was pragmatic, logistical work. And I remember the moment that I sort of lifted my head and realized, oh, I did it. And it was a morning. I'd moved to a new apartment. I had two little kids. And I opened up my kitchen cupboard and all of my favorite mugs were there and they were in the way I liked them. And the tops were up. And I just remember thinking, oh, it's like this little beautiful chorus of cups just singing and everyone's happy and that cups are happy and I'm happy and everything's going to be okay. And I realized how much lighter the entire house felt, and me included. I don't know if I would have used the word happy at that point, but that's the first time I felt hope.
That's so nice that you had a cup moment. I can so relate to that because those tiny moments are the things that really get you. What is the way that you like the cups in the cupboard?
Up. I prefer them up. So the mouths are standing up.
Who puts them facing down?
That's why divorce is a thing.
Oh, wow. That's a divorceable reason in itself.
Yes. Yes.
I've never come across that as a way to store cup. Who putting the mouth down? Oh, no.
No. Yuck. Mm-mm.
I'm so glad you're divorced.
Thank you.
Just for that. I love that little cup moment and all your favorite cups as well, because that's so important. I have two favorite mugs, and if they're both dirty and I haven't used them, I'm fuming, really angry.
I agree. Yes. No, it's very, I mean, it's the first thing in the morning. It's how you start your day. It has to be right.
Well, do you want to, before that magical cup moment, do you want to take us back to where you were in the world and your life when the divorce process started?
One thing that surprises me, or surprised me, about divorce is how long of a process it is, right? I think so many people, once they knew I was divorced and I moved a few times and I would introduce myself and they'd find out, the big question is, how did you know? Right? And I don't know that there are a few different ways of knowing. I would say the first time was through a medium. I've never actually told this story, but I just sent my friend to this amazing medium and she had an incredible experience and it reminded me of mine.
By medium, we mean like a spiritual.
Oh, yes.
Psychic.
Yes. And I should preface that by saying I'm a complete skeptic. I am an academic. I am, you know, a serious person. I thought it was pretty wackadoo, but a friend was like, no, it's amazing. So I figured I would try. And so I went to meet with her and I was maybe 3 months pregnant. So you couldn't quite, I wasn't very visibly pregnant. And I went and we talked about, I don't know, for 40 minutes about career, which was amazing because I really needed that at the time. And then at the end, she said, is there anything else you'd like to know? And I said, well, what about relationships? And she said, oh, the man that you're with right now, he's not the one. And now this was my husband. I had had one child with him already. I was about to have a second. And my face must have said, what? And she just quickly said, and you know that. And in that moment, I actually did know that. But I didn't let myself know it. Because that's a really scary realization, especially being pregnant and tied to somebody in that way. So that was sort of the first time that there was something inside my heart that said, yeah, this doesn't feel quite right. And then I would say the time that actually the divorce began was years later. I would say 2 years later, I was in my bookshop and packing up. And I had this rural bookshop in Pennsylvania, tiny 250 square feet, only books that I love. And I often had my sons there because they were so little. So I'd be nursing one in the corner and trying to check someone out. And in a place like that, people tend to confess things. Little bookstores are almost like churches in that way. And so it wasn't strange for people to come in and sit and just chat. And a friend came in at the end of the day, I was packing up, and she said, can I say something? And I thought, okay, she needs to talk. Sure, I'll make the time. And I sat down and said, of course. And she said, you know, you can leave, right? And I was shocked. And this friend took a real chance. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, your marriage, you know, you can leave your marriage. I don't think I did know that. I think at that point, it just wasn't an option to leave. And divorce was for other people, but that opened a door that was never closed again. I had been trying so hard to save it and slamming up against the door, trying to break it open, and realized, oh, that's not how I save it. I save it by walking out the door and saving me and my kids. And it took somebody else from the outside to sort of notice it, notice something in the way that we were interacting, and be brave enough to chance losing a friendship, because that's a scary thing to say to someone. But she really saved my life.
It's so interesting that it was, as you said, two people from outside who said it to you first. Do you think if either of them hadn't said those things, it would have changed things?
Wow, I never thought about that. I don't know. For whatever reason, as a woman in the 21st century, I still required permission from someone else to claim agency. And I hate saying that and feeling that, but it was true. And I don't think I'm in that place now. But then I was still in a place where I needed someone to give me permission. And I think it would have taken so much longer to have gotten to a place where I could have given myself permission.
It's interesting that we still need permission. It's true. I can relate to that as well, because I have a hearing aid and I have hearing loss in both ears, but it's worse on one side. And for a long time, I sort of needed permission from someone to understand that I was allowed to call myself deaf, because you can be deaf if you have any sort of hearing loss. But it was almost like, oh, I'm not allowed because I'm not deaf enough. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me actually of a woman I knew many years ago was setting up an experts agency, so getting experts to talk on TV about different things. And she said it was impossible to find women because women would never say that they were an expert, whereas men would say that they were experts and not be, was her experience. Mm-hmm. Hashtag not all men, hashtag not all women, but lots of them. So I wonder if it's a society gender thing, or if it's all of us being allowed permission or needing permission.
I wonder too. I was in a training recently and they said something similar, that the reason that women often don't move up as quickly as men in the corporate world or academic world is a job post will go out, and even if a man has 20% of the qualifications, they'll throw their resume in and say, well, you never know. And for a woman, it takes having at least 80% of the qualifications before she'll consider putting her resume in. And I think there's something to be said there, especially when you are, like I was, a mother of two toddlers, essentially trying to, I was the breadwinner, I was the mother of two toddlers, I was keeping house. My brain only had so much space to devote to me. And thinking, even the luxury of thinking, what do I want? Is this what I want? Am I happy? What's happy? nobody's throwing up on me at the moment. I guess I'm happy. But I do know plenty of men who I've spoken to since my own divorce, because it is like a cult. Once people know you're divorced, they'll tell you things. I do think that there are lots of people on both sides who are unhappily married and don't know what to do about it. I think the expectation, the cultural pressure of divorce equals failure, and not just capital F failure, but a personal failure. You fail as a person. I think that that is true for everyone across the board. And I think my partner now came from the other side of divorce. And so I initiated, he ultimately initiated, but it started on the other side, and it's painful for everyone. And I think it's wrapped up in a fantasy that we've been sold. And I think letting go of the fantasy is one of the hardest parts, realizing, wow, I am never going back to that moment right before I got married when I thought, this is forever. Every relationship that I enter into from this moment forward has a caveat. And I think that's healthy. I think that's great, but there is loss and some grief involved in that.
It's interesting about, you know, you saying, of course, it's painful for both sides. I think a lot of the men I've spoken to seem concerned with the failure aspect, and also concerned with hurting, because quite often it's the man is seen as the one, or assumed to be the one, that has done bad things Sometimes they have. But, you know, quite often in that stereotypical divorce scenario we all seem to have, it's, or the man's done terrible things, so they have to break up. Whereas a lot of the women I speak to, it seems more, yeah, well, when am I allowed to be happy? What is happy? Am I allowed to choose myself, though, because there's a family? And even if you don't have children, I think that's a thing of like, you still have a family unit, which you see as the marriage, and it's breaking up of that, which is interesting. Mm. So you were the breadwinner and the mum of two and doing the childcare while you're at work.
Yes.
How was your mental health at that time?
Pretty in the ditch. It was cumulative. So it's not like that happened overnight, but a friend was just called out a section of my book that's coming out in May about, there was a moment when I was in the country. I moved from New York City to rural Pennsylvania, and I love the country. It's amazing. However, I didn't miss the city, but I missed who I was in the city. And I think moving locations also made me forget what was possible, who I was, who I could be. And there's this feeling of remembering almost a ghost of myself, you know, moving with purpose with my bag full of books, and I'm commuting and getting in the subway and getting my coffee and asking people for things. Agency, it comes back to that, right? And then in a beautiful way, right? Everything's slower in the country. But it was also, I had a very difficult time with early motherhood. I was a very reluctant mother. It was never in my plan. It felt like for many years, things sort of just happened to me. What I realize now, you know, 13 years later, and through lots of therapy and through writing the process of writing a book, I really only became the mother that I believe I'm capable of being after I left the marriage. And I think that's a story that doesn't get told enough. I was not able to be the partner or the mother that I wanted to be, hoped I could be, thought I should be, as long as I was married to the person I was. And so much of my brain was wrapped up in damage control. Are the cups the right way? Right. And yes, are we going to make rent? All of those things I couldn't focus on in the way that would have been satisfying, that would have made it, the relationship, the mother-child relationship, satisfying in the way that I wished it could have been when they were very little. And so it took leaving and becoming more in control of my headspace, my life, that really allowed our relationship to bloom in a way that feels healthy, productive, right? Where I feel, oh, motherhood could be fun. Like even that concept was was completely not really there when they were very little. And I don't know if that would have been different. I don't know if that was my chemistry or, you know, purely a symptom of my situation, because I still joke, I don't like children. I like my children, but I am not like I have really good friends who are elementary school teachers. And I think that would be my nightmare, having 20 around you, surrounding you, asking for things. Oh my God. But once I had the ability to return to myself, and then I had something to give, and then I was able to receive from them, I think the mental health aspect was complicated on a lot of different fronts. And I can see that now. I couldn't see that then. I was too far in the ditch to even think about it.
And so do you think it was just the control thing that made you a better mother after your divorce and the headspace? Or were there any other aspects that made you a better mother?
My therapist would be so mad that I'm talking in a positive way about control right now. We work on that all the time. I know that control is not real, but knowing when I wake up in the morning that my day is not determined by someone else's weather and emotions, and wondering, what are we going to get today? Hearing footsteps and your whole body preparing, right? It's amazing how taxing, emotionally and physically taxing, that can be. And that lets up for a ton more time to relax and just be with other people. And I think that was a gift when I first left, because I left and I got a full-time job and I moved about 3 hours away. So it really was just me, my two little ones in a place I'd never been. And it was hard to find people to rely on to make it possible for me to work. So I had a few students who would come and babysit my kids, or the kids would, you know, on sick days, they would just hide under my desk, which was not the best parenting, but what do you do? And one in particular, who I'm still friends with today, she's actually one of my closest friends, a student. It turned out she became a professional nanny for a few years after college. It was so natural for her. And I would watch them and I realized she isn't just doing this for money. She's actually enjoying this. She's enjoying my children. She's enjoying being with them. She's having fun. And I learned so much from that caregiving experience that care can go both ways. And that was unfortunately new to me, which it shouldn't have been, because my mother is an amazing caregiver. And she was not just as a mother, but as a job, she worked in hospice. And I think that is some of the most selfless care you can give. But a lot of it was private and seemed not like something you could learn. It seemed natural. And I just thought, I must not be a natural mom or partner. It also made me question, okay, so maybe, yes, there are some things that I wish he didn't do, but of course it's my fault too. And maybe some of that is my inability to be a good partner. I know that now that's not true. But at the time I thought, maybe I'm just broken.
I can relate to that feeling. I think a lot of people can, or will too. And what impact do you think, because you say it made you a better mother, what impact do you think it had on your children, your divorce?
My older son was very angry for many years. And I think he thought it was all his fault or his brother's fault. They were little, 3 and 5 when I left. And so that was 8 years ago. And I know a lot of friends right now who are debating, do I just wait until they get to college and then I can be free? And I thought I had that debate as well. And wait until they're grown out of the house, and then I'll deal with myself. For me, that was not an option because the household was so unhealthy that I realized I'm not keeping anything. I'm not making a happy home for them right now. It's not like I'm not leaving a happy home. So I can build a happy home on my own. And I did. And I think that was one of those aha moments of realizing, oh, we can have a kitchen dance party every night. We can put art anywhere we want on the wall. You can finger paint on the wall. We can do whatever we want. This is amazing. And there was a lightness. You know, it was still complicated. I still feel a lot of guilt about that. But I do know that it wouldn't have been a better choice to stay. I think both choices were difficult. And for them, now that my son is older, his main question was always why. And I couldn't tell him in a way. He came out of the womb at like 45. And so he's always just been a different type of child. And so I would often feel bad when they would say, you know, when will we see daddy, asking these questions? And I would say, how about we get ice cream? And sort of, you know, until they became old enough. And even then, it was very important to me because I understood early on, whatever you say about your ex, your children here, about that it's about them. So I always did my best, not perfect, but I always did my best to keep that very close to the vest in terms of what they actually knew. But they knew, I mean, they lived there. So they knew, and they knew there was more to the story. And I think what's interesting now is they're growing older and I do share a little bit more with them. It's almost a relief, because it's so much scarier, I think, to have this abyss that you then fill with your worst nightmares than sometimes what reality is. I don't know a better way, because some things just aren't age appropriate. But I know for my older son, he's asking particular questions and I'm actually answering them in an age appropriate way. He now is experiencing sort of a lightness. And I think a lot of that is wrapped up with, I thought it was me. I thought it was my fault. And that's heartbreaking.
I spoke to a therapist for children who's been divorced herself, and she said a common trait that goes on with slightly older children is that they blame themselves. So it's not just you.
Right.
just in case that makes you feel better, that, you know, that's a common thing. And it's interesting you say about that debate of should I just stay until the children are older. And when I got divorced, you know, we didn't have any children, but my parents separated when I'd left home and when my sister was older. And for me, I think it was just as hard, because also I thought, well, have we all just been living a lie then for the last 5, 10 years or whatever it was? You know, what? Why have we been doing this? And also I knew they weren't happy. And I actually, you know, said to them, I wish you'd split up sooner, because I want you both to be happy. And I knew that you weren't happy. So just to hear it from the other side of things.
Thank you.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ding dong. It's the ad break. This podcast is sponsored by Penguin in the Room, an award-winning company that can manage your business's social media. They even manage our podcast, Instagram, and Twitter. Just email info@penguininthe.com for a quote. Also, if you'd like to support the podcast, you can by buying merchandise from our website, www.thedivorcesocial.com. Ding dong.
So I'm interested in your job title that I introduced you as at the beginning, essayist. I've never heard someone call themselves that before. I'm presuming that, you know, someone who writes essays, but why is that? Because obviously you've written a book as well. Why is that an important job title for you?
Okay, I'll try not to nerd out too much about it, but I think I am a nonfiction writer. And I love reading poetry and fiction. I wish I could write both of those genres. I cannot. I just am not skilled in that way. And so when I process something and it comes out in writing, it's always nonfiction. And I've been writing, I think my first book came out in 2008, and that was a memoir. It had chapters. But really, it was essays sort of in disguise. And I think it's just a question of when you write what your natural canvas is. And the book that is coming out in May, which is called The Leaving Season, a memoir in essays, I think is more true to how I see myself as a writer. I love the essay form. I think there are amazing essayists at work today who do really funny things, smart things, like Lindy West and Samantha Irby, and, you know, the sort of greats like Joan Didion, Virginia Woolf, right? There's an incredible lineage of female essayists in particular. And I also co-edit anthologies of other women's work, essay work. So the one that just came out is called Wanting: Women Writing About Desire. And we also had another one about home. I'm a first generation college student, blue collar kid. I was an only child. We were always fine. I was never hungry, but I always understood that we were especially viewed from other towns, less than, right? And so there's class is very interesting to me. And I think essays, especially in this time period, are a real subversive way to achieve voice in a way that was not available, especially to women and people of color, even 20 years ago. And I think the essay form, personal essay, personal story, it's as old as humans, right? Storytelling around a campfire is essentially today's personal essay. And so I really love sort of being an advocate for this form of writing, mostly because I've, over the years that I've taught it, I've seen people move from thinking they don't matter and that their voice doesn't matter to realizing I can take space in this world. And I certainly dealt with that feeling. And so that is why that is the first identity in my bio.
I love it.
Thank you for asking.
You're welcome. So what is the difference between an article and an essay and a book? Or a chapter in a book?
Sure. So I would say an article, and I write those too, is typically reported. It's supposed to be neutral. I don't quite believe in neutrality. But from the journalism world, which I also taught in journalism school, it is, you know, just the facts, ma'am. And it's supposed to not have your personal voice or opinion up front.
I'm now thinking all of the articles I've ever written are actually essays.
Yes, probably. Yes. The problem is we get the kids in, you know, third or fourth grade and teach them the 5-paragraph essay. And then everyone fucking hates the essay from then on. And my children hate essay. And I try to explain, you don't know what it is yet. And then the college essay, right? That's the other essay that everyone, oh, well, yes, you have to, it's fake. You have to, you know, doctor this piece of paper to stuff your whole life in and say, again, am I worthy? Will you take me? Am I good enough? So those two things, essay really has a lot going against it, but essentially it's anything with an I. And sometimes not. Sometimes there are fun experiments that are halfway between poetry and essay that can be a collective voice, can be told in second person with the you. So there are fun things like that. And then a book. So typically that's considered a memoir. And really the main difference is for my first book, which is called Welcome to Shirley, a memoir from an atomic town. It's about nuclear waste and class and is not a beach read. But you have to read it from the first page to the last. There's a clear narrative arc, or you won't really know what's going on. In my new book, it's a memoir in essays. So while there is a chronology and a narrative arc, you can read it and it's meant to be read from the beginning to the end. You could also pop in at any point, pick up just one essay and be located and not need too much backstory to just take that bit.
This is so interesting because normally I write children's books, but I've just written my first nonfiction, which is called Living with Hearing Loss and Deafness. It is, I think it's essays because I think you can dip in and out with each chapter. So I've learned something.
Yeah.
Thank you.
See, you're an essayist too.
I'm an essayist. And also I thought when you were explaining it there, it sounds a bit like journaling, which a lot of people suggest as a thing to do when you're getting divorced or when you're going through something in your life. Because I guess journaling is like mini daily essays for yourself.
Absolutely. I would not have gotten through without my journals. I have a stack of them. And I think the journals also help as timestamps, because often you think, did that really happen? Was it really that way? And then there's evidence. And I think that's the beauty of the essay as well. My opinion will change, right? If I read something that I wrote 5 years ago, that's the difference between what you asked earlier, an article, journalism, an essay. The facts won't change, right? That event happened that day, and 5 years from now, that event still would have happened that day. But I'm a different person, so I have a different experience that might impact the way I would probably rewrite a piece today. But I think that's a really beautiful kind of journalistic snapshot through the journals that you can go back and visit your past selves. And that's painful, but also very useful, especially in moments of transition like this.
Yeah. I mean, we've never really gone into it, I don't think, in depth on the podcast, but I started writing, I called it a diary at that time, when I was still with my ex, but I was thinking, am I happy? What is that? What's going on? And I think that when you start it like that, you only seem to write on the bad days. So when you look back, it is just a sequence of bad days. But I used to put the dates so I could tell how often they were. Mm. And then I tried to do it again when after we'd separated, when I was going through that kind of transition time. And then you're right. It's so interesting to look back. And even though you wrote it, it's like seeing it there in black and white makes it real and a fact. And you're like, oh, wow, I did feel like that a lot. And now I feel like this. And then looking back at it when I was happy, I was like, wow, it's not all in my head. Because I think once you get to a place of happiness, and also you've retold your story so many times to all the different people that you've had to introduce yourself to or explain it to, or doing a podcast, that when you think, did that actually happen? Or is that like developing itself, like taking on a story of its own through all the retellings, and actually going back and reading it in my diary had a big impact on me. So maybe that's a good bit of advice for anyone listening who's in that place of like, should I get a divorce? Is this something I want? How do I feel? You know, start writing things down just for you.
I love that idea. And that private space is so important because it's independence and it's safe. I remember one of the first things I did when I knew I wanted to get a divorce was take out a safe deposit box. I had nothing to put in it, but it just felt important to have a space, a little box for something that I might need to secret away. And that gave me joy and power knowing that existed. And I did ultimately put things in, but
I was going to say, is there anything in it now? What's in there? Fake passports.
Yeah, fake passports, lots of cash. No, it was around the corner from my bookshop. On the bad days, I would go on my lunch break, and I was very careful to choose a bank that I had never used and that I knew my husband at the time hadn't used because it was a small town. And I remember waiting in line, and I had, I think, $60 in my pocket or $58 something, and thinking maybe I have to open an account to get a safe deposit box, and going up to the teller. And it was this sort of old railroad town, so everything was marble and it was empty, but she was speaking very loudly and I was trying to whisper. And I said, you know, I'd like a safe deposit box. And she said, oh, do you have an account here? And she, I remember this moment because she looked up and looked at me and I could see something click in her mind. And I just wrote about this recently because I understood that I was not the first woman to stand in front of her asking for a safe deposit box. And she knew exactly why I was there. And she said, absolutely, I will help you. And no questions asked. And she just got me to that space. And I would go, and you get this little room with no windows and a door to close. And I would just sit in the room with my empty box and just feel safe. And it's a really strange experience now. It feels similar to a journal for as long as you have privacy, as long as you can keep that to yourself. And a really wonderful writer and friend, Rebecca Wolf, who wrote All of This, which is an amazing memoir of she and her husband planned to get a divorce. They were about to, and then he was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and was going to die in 3 months. So they stayed together for those, and they had 4 kids. I was on a panel with her recently, and she said, did you ever notice that little girls are given journals, the little pink journals with locks? The boys don't get locked journals. And she said, as a kid, she always thought, oh, it's to protect my secrets. But as a woman, she realizes, no, it's to protect everyone else from what's in that fucking book. And because it's scary, right? That's writing something down enacts change. It makes it real, just like you said. And I think similar when you speak it out loud, as long as it stays in your head, it's safe.
That's so true. I don't think I'd ever try and read a boy's journal, but I'd be like, oh, a diary with a lock. Let's see what's inside. It almost makes me want to read it more.
I agree.
Maybe all my new books that come out, like my published books, I'm going to include a lock on them.
Oh my gosh, that's a brilliant marketing plan.
Be like, you can only read it if you've got the key and if you buy it, obviously. The key will be available to purchase.
Yes.
So do you think your writing helped you, and did you write during your divorce?
I was really frozen for a good part of that. I journaled, but I couldn't write in the way that I normally do, for not even for publication, but thinking about this as a piece of literature, like a piece of art. I was not in that place. And a friend pulled me into a great project, an anthology project called This Is the Place, Women Writing About Home. And she said, you know, you wrote this great essay a few years ago. Can I use that? Or would you want to write something new? And I thought, oh my God, my home is imploding. What can I can't write about home. But I really wanted to read everyone else's. And so I wound up co-editing that with her. And it was amazing to have all of these essays from all of these women come in, and also to remember that they were drafts. So I got to see their first drafts, and also remember it didn't have to be perfect, the first draft. And they changed the concept of home for me, because home is the first place that we're often loved, but it's also the first place we feel fear. It's the first place our heart is broken. Lots of the writers wrote about trying to return to their original home, and, you know, by recreating it or with their own families and failing. And others wrote about just trying to run the hell away from it. And it's so interesting that home, you know, the book was meant to push against that sort of hallmark treacle of home is where the heart is kind of thing. And more, you know, home is a four-letter word, mostly for women who are supposed to find their purpose in the home. And often that's not the case. And so I worked with all of these amazing writers, and then it was my turn, and I had moved. I was in my second place. So it was at least 2.5 years, and I sat down and I was ready to write. And I still couldn't, a version of that is in my new book, but I rewrote it. So exactly what we were talking about, because so much had changed and the point of it had changed. And so I used sort of the skeleton of it, but reworked it. And it was called The Leaving Season. And that became the title essay of the new book and collection. But I've really felt I could only do that with the support of this sort of, I'm going to use the word chorus again. It's just like those little cups, the support of this chorus of women who are also writing and experiencing and being vulnerable. I wasn't talking with friends about it, the divorce and that experience yet, but having those pages on, and some people talked about divorce. It was not a divorce book. There was plenty of other things in there, but just being reminded that other women who I certainly did not think of as weak or failures or negative in any way, there were these incredible, smart, accomplished women who had really complicated feelings about home. And that gave me permission to have them myself.
It sounds a little bit like this podcast of me talking to other people and hearing their stories helped me feel less alone, and you reading their stories. And even if it's not about divorce, but just, I think, hearing from other people who, you know, everything isn't shiny and perfect and glowing all of the time,
yeah,
is a lovely reminder of, you know, we're all human beings and messy human beings. And so what does home mean now for you then?
I'm still figuring it out. I think what I understood was that it isn't static. And I think especially when I moved the second time with my kids into a place that I knew I'd be in for more than just a year, I thought a lot about, okay, I'm going to get the perfect rug and the perfect lamp, and this will be perfect and that will be perfect and everyone will be happy. Or if I could only save enough to get that couch, or, you know, then things would be good. And what I realized, again, through writing about it, meanwhile, home was happening for my kids already. It wasn't going to wait until I decided, okay, now we're home. It was happening, and it was us. And so it was us at the table playing cards. It was us at the breakfast table, you know, having our silly morning squabbles. It was the shoes at the door. It was all of these things that they are already making the memories of their own home. And I realized I don't have control over that. It's already happened. And my hope, and I think I actually asked this of the medium, you know, will I have a happy home? And that, I think it's the question, not the answer, that is home to me. It's that hope of existing in a place where home is somewhere I want to be. And my kids do too.
That's so nice. And that's such a great question. I don't think I've ever asked myself that question. And I think now I have a happy home, which is kind of amazing, because I definitely didn't used to have a happy home. And I'm even in the same house as I was with my ex, but it's very happy now.
Yeah. It's the people.
It's nice.
Yes.
Thank you for helping me come to that resolution. That's nice. I'm going to be smiling all day now. So how far along now are you in your journey? How many years ago was your divorce?
Well, it took a very long time because I was, you know, half leaving. I crossed a state border, so I had to really wait until the kids could be considered residents, and then where, how long, you know, all these ridiculous laws about, well, if you were married in this state, you have to wait 1 year. If you were married in that state, you have to wait two. Just more examples of men not trusting women to make their own decisions. And so I think all in all, it took 5 years. That was, so I left 8 years ago, divorced for about five. And so now it's been 3 or 4. And it's funny how those dates meant so much a few years ago. And now, like, what? Oh, that was just the before time. I don't know. I got divorced before COVID. That's that much I know. I just got an email from a friend who's also recently divorced. And she just said, and the sex, chef's kiss.
Yeah.
That part was very fun, which was terrifying at first, of course, but then you realize, oh, desire has a completely different definition as a 40-something than it did as a 20-something. And I'm much less concerned about, are they desiring me? Am I desirable? Am I worthy? And I am now able, the first question is, wait, do I desire this? Is this what I want? What do I want? And I think that has shifted the whole experience. And I wish that on everyone. And I just moved in with my boyfriend, who's also divorced. And I think that was really a key part of our relationship, understanding each other. We were both still going through it when we met. And so now it's a whole different crazy chapter, which is, I don't think it ever gets easy, but it is amazing to go through the craziness of life with somebody who actually is a really good partner and friend and feels like you're in it together. And even though we're not married, I think we probably feel closer to what I imagined married would feel like. I don't know if I have the appetite to get married again. I think the word is just, I have a lot of thoughts on it, but I and a lot of it has to do with legal patriarchy bullshit. But in terms of us being together, it feels very different than any relationship I've had in the past. And I think it's mostly because I am so different and I'm expecting different things. And that is, as devastating as divorce is, I think that change, and it's not necessarily fear of being divorced again, or I think it's the courage knowing that it happened. The worst has already happened and I did it. I did what I needed to do and I survived. And if it happened again, I would survive again. So that knowledge really makes it easier to move forward, I think.
It's interesting because I've recently moved in with my boyfriend. And I sort of thought when I first started the podcast, that's going to be my end moment. Like that is going to be like, I got divorced. I remember being like, I'm never going to meet anyone again. No one's ever going to love me again. I'm never going to love anyone else. And then I thought, oh my gosh, when I meet someone and live with them, like in a long-term relationship, that's going to be it. My full circle moment. And now I'm like, oh gosh, no, the journey continues. It's like, there's hangovers from your past relationship that you thought you'd healed and then come up and then, you know, and it's fun and exciting, but it's definitely not a full circle moment. It's like a, we went up on a curve and now we're in a wavy bit, which is fun, but it's not a circle. I think for people who followed me from the beginning of the podcast, because it's been a few years now, it's so nice to be in a happy, healthy currently feels relationship. But yeah, as you said, a lot of that is me and the healing I've done and the way I'm approaching this in a very different way to my marriage. So it's a real learning point. And I used to really want to get married again. And now I'm not so sure. So and it's not actually a patriarchy thing. It's just like a, well, do I actually, is that important? What does that mean? Like, is, you know, is that a marker for whether a relationship is good or not? I don't know if it is anymore. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. I've sort of been on a bit of a journey with that myself. So you're 8 years on. Why did you decide to write a book now?
Yeah, it wasn't originally about divorce. It became that. And I think it was probably inevitable, but originally it was about place and isolation and anxiety and all of these things. And the more I wrote, I realized, okay, there is another through line here. And it is the life cycle of a marriage. And my agent said, every divorce story begins as a love story. And I think that was important to keep in mind too. And I think it was very helpful for me to go back to those early days and remember, instead of just shutting it in the closet, remember what happened, why I made those decisions. And it also helped give me compassion for my ex in a way that in the middle of those heated divorce moments, you sort of lose that. And I think also he will always be the dad of my kids. And I want to be able to deliver that to them as well. And I think that's not to say that both people don't exist, right? It was definitely a difficult relationship, but he's human and has his own things to solve as well. And I do hope that he's an artist. And so he processes through paint. But for me, I think what I realized is when people would find out that I was divorced, they had so many questions and everyone felt so alone. I wish that I had a book that didn't just tell me it was going to be okay, because it's not. It's hard. And I also wished I had a book that made me feel less alone. That's my hope. It's terrifying to be this vulnerable on paper and realize, oh, anyone could walk into any bookstore and open it. Although it is more scary to have to imagine people I know reading it. But going back to the idea of why I believe in the essay, so much of divorce, I think the people that need it the most are the moms who are just so terrified to lose their kids. And so they don't make a move. And I've been there. I've felt that multiple times in many different ways. And I can't say that it'll be fine for anyone. But I think knowing that other people have been through it and have thought the same things and have done it, I hope that that can at least be helpful.
Amazing. Well, can you remind us the title of your book and where people can get it,
yes,
please?
It is called The Leaving Season, A Memoir and Essays. And you can get it at any independent bookstore, bookshop.org, you know, the big scary megalith who will deliver it right to your house, and Barnes and Noble, all those places. It comes out May 9th, right by Mother's Day. But you can pre-order it at any of those places right now.
And can you remind us how we can find you online and get in touch with you?
Yes, I am easily found at kellymcmasters.com, KellyMcMasters.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. I really appreciated this conversation. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Oh, hi. Thank you for listening to The Divorce Social with me, Samantha Baines. Please leave us a review. Please, please. It would be super nice. They're lovely to read. They keep me cheery and happy and keep me going. But also, it affects our listing in the podcast charts, which are very important because that's how more people find the podcast. And I'd love to help more people get through those really tough heartbreak and divorce times. And they're more likely to find us if we're higher up on the charts. So if you'd like to leave a review, I'd love you forever. You can leave them on iTunes is the big one, or most podcast platforms do them as well. I'll take all the reviews you've got to give. You can also get in contact on Twitter and Instagram at DivorcePod and at Samantha Baines. We have a website, thedivorcesocial.com, and we have a Patreon account, which means that you can support the podcast for as little as £2 a month. And it helps me with all the admin costs. It also means you have access to our 90s style divorce and heartbreak chat room. And there's lots of exclusives on there, little bits of audio that you don't get in the main podcast, and some giveaways as well. So I'd love to see you over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Samantha Baines. And please leave a review. Did I say that already? Please leave a review. Love you forever.